Hello, welcome to From Ohio. I'm your host, Phil Smrek. This episode's guest is a five-time Grammy and two-time Emmy nominated artist and the purveyor, preservationist, and promoter of the Great American Songbook. You may recognize his voice from singing a rendition of the Nat King Cole classic L.O.V.E. in the first season of Why Women Kill on Paramount Plus. His latest album, Gershwin Country, just dropped. It's a country and western interpretation of Gershwin classics sung as duets with icons like Dolly Parton, Roseanne Cash, and Lyle Lovett. I am delighted to say that America's all-American performer, composer, and arranger, Michael Feinstein, is from Ohio. So, the first question I had for Michael was to tell us where he got the idea to do a Nashville take on Gershwin classics.
It just came to me when I was lying in bed one morning. I got this crazy idea, and it was one of those ideas that stayed with me, so it wasn't just like the residue of some nightmare, but actually something that later made sense to me. And the more I started thinking about it, it had wings, you know. It just started to come together. So it's one of those odd things that seems incredibly unlikely, but
seeing that it seems so unlikely, when you approach some of the people that are on it, for example, you've got Ronnie Millsap on the album, Lyle Lovett, Vince Gill, Roseanne Cash, did they sort of give you a second take and say, well, let me give that a thought, or let me tell me a little bit more about it, or were they just right on board right away?
Everybody was right on board.
Wow.
Everybody was right on board. There sometimes was discussion about what they would sing, but they were on board.
And what about Liza Minnelli? Now, she performs on the album, but she was also a producer. So can you tell us a little bit about her role in producing the album?
Liza is a Gershwinophile because she was named after the Gershwin song,
okay.
Liza.
Uh-huh.
Ira Gershwin was best man at the wedding of Vincent Minnelli and Judy Garland, and Vincent Minnelli was very good friends with George and Ira Gershwin. And Liza knows Gershwin as well as anybody on the planet. So when I was telling her about the recording, she asked if she could be involved. And I said, of course. And she became an executive producer because she contributed with song ideas and casting of different artists. And so it was appropriate for her to take that role. And then I asked her if she would sing a track, which is sort of a bonus track, and she generously said yes to that, singing Embraceable You, which is a song that was her father's favorite and her mother sang in the movie,
right.
Girl Crazy.
Which is how the album ends, actually, yeah.
Yeah, so
beautiful.
It was great.
Hey, well, you know, I also, I was so impressed when I was doing a little bit of research on you that you actually get out and perform like 150 to 200 days a year. Is that right?
Yes, of course, it's been slowed down the last couple of years dramatically, but for the last 30 years, I've been on the road more than not.
Right. And you're out now promoting, you're doing a bit of touring now to promote this album, yeah?
I've been doing that, and I've been touring with a Judy Garland centennial show, which is multimedia, and it's gotten quite wonderful reception. And then I'm getting ready for my Pasadena Pops symphony season. I conduct
right.
the Pasadena Pops Orchestra in the summer, so I'm putting that together. So there's a lot of balls in the air, but I guess that must be what I like.
Hey, so listen, of course, the show's, you know, from Ohio. So what I want to find out a bit from you is about, you left Ohio when you were 20 to go out to L.A., but let's talk a little bit about that time between the time you were born and the time you left Ohio. And I'm curious to find out, how did your family sort of end up in Ohio? You know, maybe your grandparents or your parents, and which part of Columbus, I think you're born in Columbus, which part of town are you from?
I'm from the east side. I lived in Berwick, and I went to Eastmore High School.
Okay. And then what about your family? Have they always been in Ohio for a few generations, or were they kind of new to it?
My parents were both born in Columbus.
Mm.
My grandparents largely came from the Ukraine, Odessa.
Yeah.
And my grandmother came to my mother's mother, whom I knew the best of the four grandparents, came to the United States somewhere in the teens, I believe, and was in the Lower East Side of New York and worked in the garment district in those sweatshops. And she eventually came to Ohio because she had relatives who had settled there. And I don't know why they came to Columbus, but she came because other members of her extended family were there. And she met my grandfather in Columbus, and they were there for a long, long time. They all of my grandparents came to Columbus, I think, in the 20s. So it was a long time.
Do you still have family back in Ohio?
I have a brother, my older brother, and cousins who were there.
Oh, okay.
And so, yes.
Nice. Well, you know, there was a period. Now, I understand you left when you were 20. You graduated, must have graduated from high school when you were about 18. So for that two-year period before you went out to L.A., what were you doing in Columbus? I understand you were playing in different bars and cafes, yeah?
Yes, I graduated high school in 1974, Eastmore High School. I was a terrible student.
Yeah.
I just barely graduated because...
Why were you so terrible?
Because the way that I learned was not traditional. And now we know a lot more about that some kids are dyslexic and have other issues. I wasn't dyslexic, but I was not a visual person, and I just was a terrible student. I couldn't absorb stuff in that way. But music, I absorbed from the time I was very young and could play the piano by ear.
Well, I was just going to say, on that note, you were starting by playing with a piano teacher, and then was it your mom or somebody that said, listen, I'm just not even going to have that teacher anymore because he's just doing it all by ear?
I started playing piano by ear when I was 5, and my parents said, well, you should have lessons. So they took me to a teacher for lessons, and she would play the lesson for me before she put the music on the piano. So I would listen to her play, and I would copy it. So after about 2 months, she put the music on the piano and said, play this. And I said, I can't. And she said, why not? You've been playing all the other ones. And I said, well, you didn't play it first. And she realized that I was listening to her and not looking at the music. So my mother was waiting in the hall, and she said, Mrs. Feinstein, do you realize that your son is playing by ear, as if it was the dirtiest word? And my mother said, yes, didn't you know that? And she said, no. And so from that point, I just continued on my own and told my parents I didn't want lessons, and I taught myself. I should say that I did work years later with a wonderful lady named Marjorie Cook, who taught me chord substitutions and taught me things about the piano that I didn't know. But it wasn't reading. It was other skills.
Can you read music now?
Poorly.
Really?
When I prepare a symphony show, I have to really go over the score very carefully, and I have to spend a lot of time making sure that I know what I'm doing. Because I'm not a quick sight reader. Everything I do is intuitive. Yeah. Everything I've done has been intuitive because I never had a plan for my life. And you'd asked earlier about what happened between high school and moving to California.
Yeah.
I played in piano bars. I played at a place on Parsons Avenue in Columbus called The Dell, which was a restaurant that had singing waiters and a piano bar. And I sat at the piano bar, and I first played instrumentally, but then people asked me if I could sing, and that's where I learned how to sing and play the piano at the same time. I learned how to accompany myself, which was no small feat. And they used to have the cast parties for the Summerstock Theater, Kenley Players there.
Oh, sure,
so
Kenley.
So I met a lot of stars. And I did that for a number of years, and I also worked for 1 year as a dance accompanist for the dance department at Ohio State University. I did a couple of other odd jobs, but mainly it was music, and I'd play for a wedding or maybe a bar mitzvah or some event. Mm. So I was making money playing music when all of my friends were in college and studying, and I would take big bucks out of that tip jar every night, and that was pretty exciting.
Well, what made you decide to go to L.A., say, versus New York? I mean, what was the thing that happened that you said, okay, it's time to leave Ohio, and I think I'm going to go to L.A.? Or, you know, maybe you were thinking about going to New York, but what was the catalyst to finally get you out of there?
I just, from the time I was very young, had a very insistent voice telling me to move to Los Angeles. It was something that was so insistent that I finally listened to it. And maybe it was intuition, I'm not sure. But it would have made sense for me to go to New York with the music that I was playing and singing, because in New York nightclubs there was Bobby Short and there were many, many other clubs where people were performing the music that I fell in love with, which is older classic popular songs of the 20th century, Broadway and Hollywood, that was very, very far from mainstream music. But I decided to move to California, and about 7 months after I moved there, I met Ira Gershwin, the 80-year-old lyricist of the great classic Gershwin songs, with music by his brother George, who had died in 1937. So it seemed in retrospect as if it was something that I was meant to do.
Yeah. Well, you know, and it, was it then, Michael, that you sort of you realized, listen, this is going to be my life's calling now, to be the ambassador and preserver and purveyor of America's songbook? I mean, did you feel that sense of ordainment, like, okay, this is my mission now?
Not in that sense. I loved the music, and I loved being able to play and sing the songs. But working in piano bars didn't seem to me to be a smart, long-term career move. And I kept thinking, I've got to do something else, because I thought, am I going to be playing in piano bars in 40 years, 5 hours a night, 6 hours a night? So I kept thinking, I've got to do something else. And I worked as a piano salesman for a while, and that was disastrous because I just wasn't a good salesman, even though my father was an amazing salesman. And so I was working for Ira Gershwin, and then I was named as Ira's literary executor. So I was going to be in charge of Ira's estate, all of his effects, and that was what I thought I was going to do with the rest of my life. And the performing part was just something I did on the side because I loved it, and I loved sharing the music with people.
Sure.
And then after Ira passed away, I had a terrible rift with his widow, Leonor, and she was able to legally push me out of that role. And so I went back to playing piano bars by default. That was late in 1983, about 4 or 5 months after Ira died. And I just kept doing what I did, even though sometimes I would be fired because I couldn't play contemporary music. So it was not any smart career move. It was just what I loved and what I knew best and wanted to do. And then I got an opportunity to play a nightclub in San Francisco, which was doing a performance as opposed to playing at a piano bar where it was sometimes background music. So I put a little set list together and played this little club in San Francisco. And I was reviewed in the local paper, and they gave me a rave, and people started coming, and it was sold out. And suddenly I had major success in San Francisco, where I was working there for 3 and 4 months at a time, selling out these performances. And from that, I got an offer to play in New York at the Algonquin Hotel. And that was a 12-week run, 2 shows a night, 5 nights a week. Every single show was sold out.
I remember that. Actually, I remember that because that's when I came to New York. That was around 1984, right? 85. Around 85?
86.
Okay, 86, right. I was at Interview Magazine then, and I remember everybody talking about this Michael Feinstein.
It was amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, it was amazing, and it happened so fast and so quickly that smoothly, I should say, that I didn't realize how unusual that was, especially singing the music that I sang. But one thing led to another, and the following summer I was playing at the Hollywood Bowl with 17,000 people.
Oh, my goodness. I understand that you have assembled quite a collection of manuscripts and memorabilia that you are trying to preserve, and I want you to talk a little bit about how that ties in with the Palladium Center in Carmel, Indiana.
Sure. Well, forgive me for correcting you, but in Indiana, it's pronounced Carmel.
Carmel.
Not like Carmel in California. It's Carmel like the candy.
Okay, right.
But to answer your question, I started collecting artifacts relating to the music that I love shortly after I moved to California. One of the amazing things about being out here, at least it was then when I moved here, was that you could find all kinds of artifacts at garage sales and estate sales and thrift stores.
Oh, the thrifting, sure, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Oh, my God, I'd find amazing
till the pickers
things.
Took over, and then there's nothing left for the rest of us.
Well, there's still things that turn up, but it's not like it used to be, because I'd find the most remarkable things. I could find a manuscript in the hand of a songwriter where people were throwing things out from his estate or rare recordings or acetates. You know, I've found things that are just beyond belief. Like I have a home recording of Judy Garland singing a song that she never sang publicly. And I've found manuscripts in the hand of Jerome Kern that came from a garage in Hollywood, and things that are just part of our cultural history that literally would have been thrown out if I hadn't recognized what they were. I have the ability to spot these things, and the universe has responded in kind by throwing them at me.
Mm.
For example, about, I don't know, 10 years ago, I was playing a concert at the Actors Fund home in Englewood, New Jersey, which is a wonderful place that is the best kind of retirement community one could hope for. And I happened to be there on a day when I saw them throwing stuff into a dumpster. And I went and looked in the dumpster, and it was piles of sheet music and books. And I took the stuff out of the dumpster. And when I got home, I opened this book. It was a copy of the play The Women, and it was signed by the author Claire Booth to the producer Max Gordon. It was inscribed to him, and that was in a dumpster. So I just seemed to be in the right place at the right time.
Mm, as my grandmother would say, and how? That's amazing. Hey, you know, I wanted to also ask you about some of the musical influences from Ohio. I'm just curious. You know, we've got our Dean Martins from Ohio, Doris Day's from Ohio, and of course the jazz vocalist Jimmy Scott. So I'm wondering if there's any particular person from Ohio that's been kind of a personal favorite of yours, either, you know, compositionally or as a performer.
My dad's favorite was the Mills Brothers, and they were from
Piqua, Ohio. Oh, I didn't know that. Yeah.
Oh yeah, yeah, they were magnificent, and they're favorites of mine. Nancy Wilson's from Ohio, and Nancy Wilson was spectacularly gifted. I had the chance to work with her one time, and I'm still gloriously transformed from that night. I'll never forget it. Man, she was superb. Those were the two influences. I mean, Lord, I loved Dean Martin. You know, Vincent Minnelli was from Ohio. When Liza's father, Vincent, was in his formative years, his parents had a circus, the Minnelli Brothers Circus, which was famous all through Ohio and the central part of the country.
How about that? Wow.
And if you ever were to go back and do research on that connection, you'll find that they were as famous as anybody in that time, and that was one of the great influences.
What time was that? What era would you say that was, the years for that?
That was the teens.
Ah.
That was the teens. Mm. That was the teens of the 20th century, and even Liza didn't know about them, and I found some contemporary reviews from, like, Billboard magazine about the Minnelli brothers, and they were a big deal.
Wow.
So that was a big influence. And, of course, one of the other big influences was on me was Paul Lynde from Mount Vernon, Ohio, which is where my aunt is from.
Oh.
He was
Paul Lynde from the Hollywood Squares?
Oh, yeah. He was from Mount Vernon. Oh, God, yes.
Gosh. I think
he
should
was always a favorite.
He could be a producer on this show, Michael. You've got a lot of information for me. Hey, you know what? We're almost out of time, so I'm going to ask you just a couple of questions. Tell us a little bit about the American Songbook Foundation that you've established.
Oh, sure. Well, because I've collected all these artifacts and I'm trying to keep this music alive, this classic American music for new generations, I started the Great American Songbook Foundation. And it is headquartered in Carmel, Indiana. And we have an annual high school songbook academy where 40 high school kids from chosen from all 50 states come to Indiana and have a week-long intensive a workshop, a songbook academy, where they are mentored and coached in singing these songs. And it's life-changing to see the way these kids bond and the way they discover this music that really is transformative for them. And so it's my little contribution to keeping the arts alive in that realm. And now I have all of these kids that I'm connected to, now thousands of them all over the place that are they're planting seeds of keeping the songbook alive. And also a lot of the collections that I've gathered are in Carmel.
Right. All right, Michael. Well, listen, we're going to go out with a little clip from one of the songs on the album. So would you like to pick a song for us to listen to?
Golly, what about I Got Rhythm? That's one I did with Brad Paisley. And that is just a joyful romp through the virtual hay.
All right. Well, listen, we'll go out with that. And I just want to say thank you so much for taking time out of your schedule to have a little visit with us from Ohio. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
You are very welcome. It's a great pleasure to do this with you. And thank you for asking me.
What you got? I got rhythm. I got music. I got my gal who could ask for anything more. I got daisies in green pastures. I got my gal who could ask for anything more. Who could ask for?
Until the next episode of From Ohio, O-H.
More.